Chapter 11, Coeducation. In September 1970, the young women who entered Colgate as freshmen, the language of the era paid no heed to their sex, were not the first to climb the hill and study with the boys and men of the grammar school and college. We know that Emily Taylor and Mabel Dart preceded them in the 19th century, and for several years, beginning in the 1880s, the Colgate Academy welcomed as many as 15 or 20 girls into its classrooms. But fears that their presence might deter male applicants ended that academy's far-sighted admissions policy in 1892. In the mid-1940s, the returning GIs also brought their wives to Colgate, some of whom were themselves WAC or WAVES veterans. A few took their place on the Hill as tuition-paying students and received national publicity thanks to a university press release celebrating them, albeit erroneously, as the first co-eds in the school's 126-year history. They did not remain long enough to receive degrees. In August 1961, three women who had completed work in a special summer session for teachers were the first to be awarded Colgate degrees. To mark the occasion, Josephine Young Case presented their MAT diplomas and said, "I am sure this would have pleased Betsy Payne, though I am equally sure it is something she never dreamed of." 2 years later, women admitted into the graduate-level teaching program were even more visible, taking classes alongside male students during the regular academic year. While the possibility of coeducation had been entertained by Ebenezer Dodge and James B. Colgate in the 1880s, the prospects for admitting women were not resurrected and seriously considered again until the 1960s. The idea gained momentum at Colgate and other elite men's colleges in mid-decade, with decisions to admit women coming in a frenzy of activity in the late 1960s. This sudden movement toward coeducation cannot be separated from the decade's other sweeping societal changes. As racial, religious, and ethnic prejudices were confronted, gender barriers also began to topple. Single-sex education seemed increasingly anachronistic, a vestige of the 19th century when colleges readied men for professions from which women were excluded. While the various female seminaries, institutes, and normal schools prepared young women for domestic responsibilities and the very few fields such as teaching and nursing open to them. While strong traditions of single-sex education still held sway among elite colleges in the Northeast, the national tally was shrinking. By 1964, only 29 non-denominational men's colleges and 37 women's colleges remained. Most single-sex colleges had to reckon with the possibility of coeducation in the 1960s. For some, it was an acknowledgement of rural isolation and the perverse patterns of social life in the institutions. Some also sought financial stability, greater operating efficiency, and opportunities to hire new faculty by expanding their student bodies to include members of the opposite sex. Some were increasingly apprehensive about competition from state university systems as resources poured into public higher education. Some even worried about the rise of community colleges, seeing them as a threat to enrollment in four-year colleges. In the post-war decades, students contemplating higher education found many more options. In a worrisome trend at Colgate, applications had started to drop, and by the late 1960s, the acceptance rate was beginning to climb. For many on the faculty, coeducation seemed inevitable, a pragmatic response to new circumstances. The decision. By 1963, coeducation was being widely discussed on campus, even though the university's 10-year projection committee had not placed the issue high on its agenda when it set to work that year. When faculty members were surveyed about admitting women in 1964, 91 were in favor and only 17 were opposed. Of those faculty members favoring the admission of women, 65 wanted full coeducation, and 26 preferred a coordinate college. Colgate's chapter of the American Association of University Professors, feeling that the university was moving too slowly toward a decision, set up its own independent study group chaired by Professor of Religion John Morris. The AAUP members strongly favored coeducation, convinced it would improve the academic tone of the college by strengthening the applicant pool, creating a more competitive classroom environment, and enhancing the arts and humanities. Not at all pleased that the AAUP had voiced so strong an opinion, and no doubt worried about the reaction of trustees and alumni, President Barnett established a separate committee in 1965 to assess the options, and he asked Dean of Faculty James Storing to chair it. Although the prospects for admitting women were already in the air, the fundraising goals established for the 1969 sesquicentennial capital campaign did not include even the most tentative plans for funding coeducation. Worried about staunch alumni opposition from older alumni, the men most likely to make significant donations, some in the administration thought the decision on coeducation should be deferred until after the sesquicentennial campaign met its goals. The worries were sincere, but general soundings of alumni opinion revealed no ardent opposition. Only about 200 alumni took the time to mail back survey cards when asked for their views. Their attitudes differed from generation to generation. Those graduating before World War II tended to oppose coeducation by a 2-to-1 margin. Those graduating in the decade immediately after the war seemed evenly split. Younger alumni were generally in favor, though the small number of respondents does not offer clarity regarding all alumni. A more substantial survey of current students in 1966, however, found them decidedly eager for it, with 52% wanting to see a sister institution established and 15% opting for full coeducation. In 1966, 80% of freshmen were in favor of admitting women. Students had been weighing in on the issue throughout the mid-1960s. In 1964, the Maroon posed a question on most every student's mind: is Colgate heading toward a switch to coeducation? The editors were clearly perplexed about what it would mean to accept female students. They were concerned, needlessly so, about Colgate's likelihood of attracting a sufficient number of bright girl applicants to become the social and, more importantly, the intellectual companions of the male undergraduates. Without the necessary selectivity, the Maroon cautioned, a formidable situation of incompatibility could arise. The editors also wondered how the academic environment of an all-male college would change, alluding vaguely to psychological studies about women's reticence in classroom discussions. Paradoxically, they also seemed to worry that women would bring in a more competitive spirit to academic life, suggesting that they would likely outshine men on written exams and papers. Uncertain about the impact of coeducation, the Maroon urged the Student Senate to begin its own study of what changes women would likely bring to the Colgate campus. In the final analysis, the Maroon editors wanted students to have a voice in the decision, while astutely conceding they would have to become better informed because the larger question of coeducation at Colgate is a complex of smaller questions which must be answered before any significant decisions are made. Although their questions would remain unanswered in the near term, the editors leaned decidedly in favor, saying the admission of women would bring academic normalcy to the all-male college. The Student Senate's Conference Committee on Coeducation in 1968 expressed a growing sense of urgency. Each day Colgate exists without having women as a part of its environment is a day in which its students are exposed to inferior educational opportunities, said the Senate. Coeducation was a step into the unknown for men's colleges. Only two all-male colleges in the region, Springfield in 1933 and Muhlenberg in 1957 had attempted the transition, and neither had accomplished it without pain. The dean at one all-male college predicted that coeducation, while probably inevitable, would be resisted and was not likely to come to his school until the end of the 20th century. Administrators at Colgate also had mixed feelings. Dean of Students William F. Griffith, class of 33, favored opportunities in higher education for women, but contended that true coeducation did not exist anywhere if it meant truly equal opportunities for women. He maintained that extracurricular activities at coeducational colleges were decidedly slanted in favor of the male. While he did not oppose the establishment of a coordinate women's college in Hamilton, he feared even that step might be risky. He looked skeptically at the relationship between Brown University and its coordinate women's college, Pembroke College, and was convinced that the close proximity of the two was the cause for what he perceived as Brown's anti-intellectualism. His close observation of nearly four decades of student life at Colgate convinced him that it was better for students to study hard and then get out of town every 3 weeks or so. Griffith's colleague, the director of student activities, Lloyd Huntley, class of 24, was adamantly opposed to coeducation, announcing that he will never vote for it, despite the fact that it might smarten up the guys. Like others, he concluded that the college had more pressing needs, completing the Art Center and new dorms, constructing a new science building, and raising faculty salaries. If key members of the administration were dubious about coeducation, many professors were much more eager to see whether it could indeed smarten up the guys. All for it, remarked Professor of Philosophy Huntington Terrell, class of 1944, who saw the male environment as unrealistic and a vacuum, especially for those without cars or who took the demands of academic work seriously and spent long hours in the lab or library. Professor of Sociology Warren Ramshaw was also in favor, viewing coeducation as an antidote to the massive, compulsive masculinity that prevailed on campus. Professor of Philosophy Herman Brautigam took a decidedly historical view, arguing that an all-male college was a projection into the 20th century of the medieval monastic ideal. The idea is an anachronism and represents a certain amount of cultural lag. Another faculty member, Professor of English Russell Spears, saw both academic and social benefits. It's in the air today. Inevitable. A good thing. In December 1965, the university began, in Dean Storing's words, to examine critically and as far as possible scientifically the problems involved in establishing a coordinate college or reconstituting the institution on a genuine coeducational basis. The university received a $15,000 grant from the Ford Foundation's Fund for the Advancement of Education to conduct the research, and a five-member committee to study coeducation worked through the next year, hearing testimony from various campus constituencies. It issued its preliminary report in January 1967 and its final report 9 months later. The committee spent much of its time on the costs and benefits of expanding the university to 2,400 or 2,500 students. Whether or not the university accepted women, expansion would require an estimated $10 million capital outlay, including $6 million for new dormitories. Taking a much longer view, the committee asked what a viable liberal arts college would look like two or three decades into the future. They saw many changes on the horizon, where public education of high quality becomes continually more accessible, where universal higher education at modest tuition appears imminent, where the press for higher education places a heavy burden on existing facilities, where women assume greater responsibilities for leadership in professional and community affairs, and where young people desire a greater relevance between formal education and personal and societal needs. Looming throughout their deliberations was the existential threat posed by state university systems. public education manifests the greatest threat to private colleges and those institutions unable to offer an educational experience of great value to society will be forced out of existence in the coming years, said the committee. Once having agreed that expansion was essential for Colgate's survival, a consensus emerged that adding women would be the best way forward and that it would strengthen the academic program. One professor, nameless in the committee report, testified that a liberal arts curriculum which excludes the ideas and attitudes of half the population could not be thought of as truly liberal education. An education shared with women is essential for the understanding of what it means to be a human being. Student representatives also testified about an intellectual atmosphere somewhat lacking in vitality. They link the pervasive academic apathy to the homogeneity of the students and to the environmental consequences of the absence of women. In the end, the report was explicit in arguing for the intellectual benefits, at least for the male students, of opening the college's doors to women. Exclusion of women from the academic environment, they said, deprives the young men of the opportunity to share with young women a learning situation which ideally molds values and a sense of responsibility. As a consequence, the total intellectual environment suffers. At the outset, the committee seemed to prefer a coordinate college, possibly a merger with Wells College in Aurora, New York, about 75 miles west of Hamilton. A separate sibling college, they believed, would allow for greater curricular innovation and more extracurricular activities controlled by women students. But the chairman of the Board of Trustees, Warren, Andy Anderson, intervened to dismiss the idea outright, recommending instead that Colgate move toward a fully coeducational campus. And despite their skepticism, he was able to bring the board along. The board was at its best in this decision, Professor John Morris said many years later, and Andy Anderson was a shrewd politician. President Barnett also reflected on the board's attitude toward coeducation, saying, "Trustees were neither wildly enthusiastic nor vehemently opposed. He portrayed their collective mood as one of resignation. They would have said, as he put it, 'We're not sure this is a good idea. We're not greatly in favor of it, but if you guys tell us it's better for the educational system at Colgate and for the financial system of Colgate, go ahead. We have to do this to make the university a first-rate, four-year liberal arts college.'" Social and behavioral concerns also weighed in their decision. The college had long suffered from the twin afflictions of Wednesday night flight and weekend-itis, which often shortened the academic work week and left the campus desolate on weekends. Students made their way to Skidmore, Wells, Vassar, and even more distant women's colleges. In a sweeping generalization about the party weekend mores of many in the student body, the committee claimed that Colgate men seemed to feel ill at ease in the presence of women and tend to hide behind an institutional image as Colgate men rather than relate to women on a personal basis. This follows from associating with women only in dating situations, they said, and not in the ordinary circumstances of college life. While the initial report had leaned toward creating a coordinate college, the costs of building a separate campus and new residence halls proved prohibitive. The final report recommended that Colgate commit itself to full coeducation while maintaining the male student population at 1,800 and gradually adding 600 female students. In October 1967, the Board of Trustees approved the report in principle, saying, "If such a move proves feasible, it should be done." Meanwhile, undergraduate women were already finding their way into the classroom. Their routes varied. The wives of two married upperclassmen were among the first to enroll, receiving their bachelor's degrees in 1969. The 1969 January term saw the arrival of 50 visiting Skidmore students, and in the spring, 15 Vassar students spent the semester on campus. Colgate men also attended Skidmore and Vassar. When the academic year began in September 1969, approximately 50 women students had transferred from these and other colleges. When 132 women arrived in September 1970 as the first co-ed freshman class, they were greeted by several dozen women in the upper classes and a cadre of residential advisors who had already spent a year navigating their way through the still overwhelmingly male environment. The transition. Speaking two decades after graduation, Gloria Borger, class of 74, speaking two decades after she graduated, said there were various reasons she wanted to come to Colgate. The chance to get an excellent education at one of the East's elite universities was one. The challenge of helping create a new coeducational institution was another. And despite our hope of becoming pioneer feminists, the fact that there were eight males on campus for each one of us was not a disincentive. Like others in the early years of coeducation, she found a male-dominated and male-oriented institution that had not fully prepared for the changes women would bring. We were seeking equality of treatment, and we got full-length mirrors and ironing boards. Among other niceties were flower pots reposing awkwardly in the urinals of the dormitory lavatories. When they arrived, they found only one women's restroom in the academic buildings on the hill. Nevertheless, with the detached perspective of two decades, many of the first women to breach the gender barrier retain fond memories of their pioneering role. "We had a kind of celebrity," said one, describing the men as curious but generally respectful. A transfer student who arrived in 1973 said she found the guys really nice, really bright. "I felt like I had gained all of these brothers." But others remembered an ill-prepared and much less welcoming college. One of Borger's African-American classmates, Diane Ciccone, class of 74, found a hostile environment, a different kind of hostility from what she had experienced in high school, with gender, race, class, and intellectual condescension all in the mix and always threatening her self-confidence and self-esteem. She felt she had neither mentors nor role models on campus, with the exception of one graduate student in the MAT program. There were only about 60 black students on campus when she arrived, and the racial divide on campus seemed to widen as the number of African-American students grew. "I didn't socialize with white women," she recalled in her oral history. "The racial chasm yielded separate social spheres and led her friends to organize a black party weekend during her second semester on campus. On reflection," she concluded, "it was a tough place, and it toughened me. That was the positive thing out of the negative. It prepared me for the real world." Her classmate, Covette Rooney, concurred, saying, "Colgate prepared me for a racist and sexist world, but in a positive way, because what I learned is that sexism will always be there." She also felt she had learned to mingle with folks from other cultures. Both would graduate and go on to law school and successful legal careers. The 132 first-year women in 1970 were followed by 167 in 1971 and 270 more in 1972. When the number of women on campus surpassed 600, the trustees reaffirmed the initial decision to maintain a limit on their numbers. But faculty and students, male and female alike, protested the continuation of the quota and spoke out in newspaper editorial, student senate resolutions, and public meetings. A committee to study the future of coeducation reported in October 1973 that it too thought the fixed quota limiting the number of women should end, and that no preference should be given to applicants on the basis of sex. The trustees dropped the admissions quota in 1974, although they continued to worry about athletic competitiveness, thinking it would suffer if the number of male students fell significantly. Longer term, they feared that alumni contributions might diminish as the alumni population grew. Some also raised questions about whether female students would skew teaching too heavily toward the arts and humanities. Setting these worries aside, Their decision was an explicit acknowledgement that female candidates for admission were measurably stronger than male applicants, and that once enrolled, women's grades tended to be significantly higher. Assessing the first 3 years of the transition to coeducation, the Committee for the Study of the Future of Coeducation reported that the overall quality of education had improved, providing a more open, varied, and challenging environment in which men and women could share the excitement of their intellectual discoveries. But the committee also understood that the mere admission of women to a historically male college had not yet transformed it into a fully coeducational college. After 3 years, it seemed to the committee that a special kind of social experiment was still underway, in which the more perceptive of the men become more aware, sometimes to their surprise, of the attitudes of superiority and defensiveness they have sometimes unconsciously expressed in their dealings with women. And the more perceptive of the women make a similar discovery about themselves in their relations with men. Overall, the report noted, a heightened awareness on the campus of the reality of discrimination against women. Outnumbered by more than 2-to-1 in the mid-1970s, women students remained conspicuous by their presence, still perceived by some as a novelty on campus. They told the authors of the 1973 report about the disrespectful whistles and calls they got while walking down Broad Street. They described certain male faculty members as condescending and inhospitable toward them. The report urged both faculty and staff to show greater sensitivity toward women students, to take their academic aspirations seriously, and to recognize that certain attitudes, such as that women are here primarily to get a husband or are here for the entertainment of the men, are not acceptable. When Michelle Cortese, class of 83, conducted interviews with a cohort of women who had attended throughout the 1970s, she confirmed these observations. Some of her informants told stories of overt harassment and abuse as they walked past fraternity houses or attended beer-sodden mixers and parties. But experiences ran the gamut, with some women also noting their enduring friendships with male classmates, relationships they described as rewarding, close and lasting, and terrific. Very few expressed regrets about their experiences in the classroom or with faculty, although some told Cortese about bemusement and irritation when professors consistently called on them to offer the female perspective on a reading assignment or discussion topic, as if their roles in class were to voice the views of all women everywhere for all eternity. Within less than a decade, women had overcome at least some of the initial obstacles and were assuming leadership positions on campus. In 1973, Gloria Borger became the first woman editor of the Maroon. A year later, some 24 students organized an all-female a cappella group, the Swinging Gates. Early on, women won posts in student government. And in 1979, Marianne Crosley, class of 80, was elected senior class president, the first woman to hold that office. Borger felt that within just a few years, we had integrated ourselves in a way that enhanced the school rather than changing the basic character of Colgate. One area in which women consciously sought to enhance rather than alter the character of the university was athletics. In their very first year on campus, women competed in non-contact intramural sports with the men and initiated informal intercollegiate competition when they challenged Cazenovia College to a tennis match. More extensive club competition with other colleges began in 1972, with teams in tennis, field hockey, volleyball, swimming, basketball, and softball playing other upstate colleges. A year later, with two women on the physical education department staff, varsity competition began in 6 sports against teams in the New York State Association of Intercollegiate Athletics for Women. As the 1980s began, women made up slightly more than 40% of the 2,500-member student body. But there was still an implicit cap on their number, and much remained to be done to achieve full coeducation in the classroom, in student life, and on the playing fields. Suzanne Keller, a Princeton sociologist and the first woman to receive tenure there, assessed the emergence of full coeducation on her campus and concluded, gender integration is not in the main a matter of admission or entry for the individual only. It is a matter of a change in the culture of a place. Institutions deeply imprinted with a masculine culture, masculine standards of performance and ambition, in Keller's view, compelled women to adapt and bend themselves to fit as well as possible to the culture already in place. They were actors in an androcentric play. Keller's description of Princeton applied as well to Colgate. After more than a decade, full coeducation had not been achieved. Indeed, among the greatest obstacles were the deeply embedded assumptions in a 150-year-old college that men were best taught by men, that women had no place at the front of the classroom, and that traditional curricula and pedagogy did not require serious reexamination. Step by step. The decision to admit women had been made hastily. Most of the planning took place over just 2 years. The path toward creating a truly coeducational college, one that would bring more women onto the faculty and result in meaningful changes to the curriculum, would take much longer. Several women faculty members recalled a meeting at Merrill House in early 1970 when they were told about the plans for the arrival of the first-year female students. They were dismayed that their advice and counsel had not been sought as plans were being made. It seemed to one of them that the goal was to get the women here and then figure out what we needed to do to educate them. When the decision to move forward with coeducation was finalized, only 5 women were teaching at Colgate. 4 were instructors, and 1 was a part-time assistant professor. Several had been teaching at Colgate since the late 1950s, hired only after the university came rather late to the realization that there was an underutilized academic talent pool already living in Hamilton. Wanda Warren Berry, the wife of Professor of Religion Donald Berry, had attended Yale Divinity School and earned an MDiv. Her academic career in Hamilton started when she was asked in 1958 to grade papers in philosophy and religion courses, and then, in 1962, to teach sections of the freshman PNR Corps. Her teaching position was so unusual that the chairman of the department could come up with no other title for her than special instructor. Over the next 40 years, she would rise through the ranks of the department to full professor along the way, departing to earn a PhD in philosophy from Syracuse University, and later publishing significant articles on topics ranging from feminist theology to Kierkegaard. Elizabeth Brackett, who held a PhD in chemistry from Stanford and was the wife of chemistry professor Thomas Brackett, also found her way onto the faculty, hired at first to teach introductory courses. She would later win tenure and serve 2 terms as director of affirmative action. Jane Lagoudis Pynchon arrived in 1965 as an instructor in English, returning to teach part-time in 1969-70 and then moving into a tenure stream position. She became provost and dean of faculty, and in 2001-2 served as Colgate's interim president. Arriving in 1970, along with the first-year women students, Carol K. Blesser, a specialist in the history of the American South, was the most senior woman on the faculty, an associate professor, and securely tenured. Of the 12 women on the faculty by 1971, 7 were still teaching, only part-time. Inaugurated as Colgate's 11th president in 1969, after serving 6 years as president of the American University in Cairo, Thomas Bartlett's primary task was to steer Colgate through the transition to coeducation, all the while confronting difficult financial markets and soaring inflation. During his 8-year presidency, the movement toward full coeducation proceeded apace, reforms often coming about because of women's sustained push to propel the university forward. Colgate changed from a completely male enclave because women worked a second or a third or even fourth shift to bring it about, Wanda Warren Berry recalled. Some of the younger women, Jane Pynchon quipped, were inventing themselves as college professors without pipe or wife. Most of the female faculty members also lack the security of regular academic appointments, and hiring decisions often took place at the last minute when they were asked to fill in for faculty members on sabbatical or when course enrollments shifted unpredictably. An essential change for these regularly relied upon but still part-time faculty came in 1972 when the women proposed the creation of Category 1 faculty appointments. This innovative approach established a more professional part-time status with pay at the appropriate academic level and expectations of productive scholarship and service to the college. This was a far cry from the piecework and uncertainty typically endured by adjunct faculty. It even offered a path toward tenure, although on an extended time schedule. Midway through his presidency, President Bartlett acknowledged the slow pace of change, explaining that the university was trying to move pragmatically, step by step, attempting to deal with real issues as we discover them and gaining new experience as we progress. In 1974, Colgate made a commitment to new hiring policies that would steadily expand the number of women on the faculty. 5 women were hired into tenure stream positions that year, an influx of new faculty now remembered as the Year of the Woman. A remarkable group of scholar teachers came to Colgate, most of them devoting their entire careers to the university. Joining the faculty were Marilyn Thee in philosophy and religion, Margaret Maurer and Lynn Staley in English, Myra Smith in psychology, and Mary Bufwack in sociology and anthropology. By the end of the decade, there were 43 women teaching at Colgate, 20% of the 219 full and part-time faculty members. But of the 178 full-time faculty, only 27 were women. In the view of the Middle States accreditation team, the university had not yet demonstrated a consistent and powerful commitment to equal opportunities for minorities and women. As their numbers rose, the women faculty inevitably brought change to the curriculum. Their first decade on campus coincided with an outpouring of new scholarship by and about women, to which Colgate faculty members made significant contributions. Wanda Warren Berry's contributions to feminist theology included her work on theologian Mary Daly. Lynn Staley wrote about a late medieval Christian mystic and published a critical edition of her autobiography, The Book of Marjorie Kemp. And Ulla Gebhard did pioneering work on women in the economy. Gradually, new courses were added to the curriculum, and female and male faculty worked together to integrate topics concerning women and gender into their existing courses. A 2-year pilot grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities helped in the development of a team-taught women's studies course, first offered in 1980. The NEH stipulated that once the grant funds ran out, the university would be expected to sustain the course with its own resources. When Charles H. Trout accepted the post of provost and dean of faculty in 1981, he announced that one of his goals was to redress the invisibility of women on campus and to introduce into Colgate's academic discourse the experiences, perceptions, and contributions of women. After a national search, the historian Anne J. Lane was hired in 1983 to develop and direct a new women's studies program. By the time of her arrival, the cluster of courses about women had already grown to some 24, enough to sustain a minor in women's studies. When an external review committee, with reviewers from Duke, MIT, Spelman, and Princeton, looked at the emerging women's studies program 5 years later, they found it surprisingly strong and varied, comparing it favorably to universities with much larger faculties. Following their assessment, a major in women's studies was approved in 1989. But the review committee's praise of Colgate's overall curriculum was qualified, asserting that the school's intellectual ethos was still dominated by its sociological legacy of educating gentlemen. The reviewers' hopes for a sound program in women's studies were further tempered by their harsh assessment of the campus climate, which they judged to be dismissive and objectifying of women. The outside assessment echoed the concerns of women studying and teaching at Colgate. Gender integration was still a struggle. Students complained that the university was neither fully coeducational nor was it systematically trying to identify problem areas. In the mid-1980s, a joint committee of students and faculty had looked back at the history of coeducation and gathered data on troublesome areas, including the allocation of financial aid, women's housing options, the availability of medical services, sexual harassment policies, athletic opportunities, and alumni involvement. They looked at other colleges to inquire how women were faring after the transition to coeducation on their campuses. In at least some respects, they were surprised by what they found. Despite the considerable work that remained to be done, Colgate appeared certainly to be no worse off in the area of coeducation than similar colleges, and in some ways, such as medical services, to be more advanced, they reported. Nevertheless, they noted that at Colgate, concern about coeducation was alive throughout the university. The committee's student survey revealed that women in the 1980s were generally happy with their academic experiences. They were pleased about their access to faculty members, the advising system, and the classroom atmosphere, but they were much less comfortable with campus and village social opportunities, especially as they advanced toward senior year. Socially, male and female students seemed to part ways over the course of their 4 years, the men socializing and eating in their fraternities, and the women pursuing more fragmented social opportunities on campus or in the village. On Broad Street, in the former Sigma Nu fraternity house, a women's residence and resource center had been established in 1977. Named Bolton House, it honored Frances P. Bolton, Elijah Payne's great-granddaughter, and a 15-term Republican member of Congress from Ohio. From 1985 to 1994, Bolton House served as the Women's Studies theme house. Despite a very skeptical faculty, the first local sorority was established in 1979 and was eventually chartered by a national sorority in 1982. It was joined over the next 9 years by 4 other sororities. Even with the formation of sororities in the 1980s, residential and social options remained problematic for female students, and there was no consensus on solutions. The report revealed the students' confusion. The equal calls at the end of the survey for more sororities or co-ed fraternities, for more women on campus or closing the fraternities, all point to the need to shift the balance of social and residential options currently available to students. But the report had no recommendation about which of the suggestions might achieve that balance. In the rapid push in the early 1970s to expand the student body and to move toward coeducation, the university made many mistakes concerning residential life. The college decided to add a mandatory summer term rather than to build new housing, a decision that fragmented class unity. The administration also convinced itself that many students wanted to live in the village rather than on campus, and by the early 1980s, more than 400 students were residing off campus, further fragmenting student life. The university also retained the traditional fraternity system despite vocal faculty opposition and a vote in 1989 to abolish Greek letter organizations by the beginning of 1994-95. Residential life would remain a nettlesome problem well into the 21st century. Theme houses would come and go. Faculty recommendations to end the fraternity system would go unheeded, though some fraternities would close their doors after suffering university sanctions or financial shortfalls. And female students clamoring for more sororities would meet with no success, despite their regular appeals to the Board of Trustees. A coda to coeducation. When faculty and students gathered to celebrate and to reflect upon 20 years of coeducation in October 1990, a Maroon editorial observed that the journey to full equality is far from its completion. Colgate's 13th president, the mathematician Neil Grabois, had arrived only 2 years earlier from Williams College. Looking at what remained to be done, he saw serious social and behavioral challenges ahead because society has repeatedly demonstrated its uneasiness with real equality. The next steps are more difficult, he said, because they touch deeply ingrained attitudes and affect long-held assumptions. From campus to workplace, traditional gender roles and female-male social interactions were changing, and profound questions about the very nature of gender, identity, and sexual orientation began to play out on campus. They did so in a new legal and public policy context for American universities. The tradition of colleges acting in loco parentis, a practice grounded in centuries of common law, was coming to an end. At Colgate, students in the 1960s had rebelled against many college regulations. Until the late 1960s, among many other rules, freshmen were required to wear jackets and ties to weeknight and Sunday dinners, as well as to university concerts. Strict parietals limiting the hours women could visit dorm rooms were in effect, though often evaded. A more consequential clamor for individual student rights echoed on other campuses, especially when students in the South joined the civil rights movement. A series of cases in the 1960s affirmed that students in public universities possessed First Amendment rights and were entitled to due process in disciplinary cases. With case law expanding the scope of student rights and students demanding more freedom from absurd rules and regulations, university administrators abandoned their role as student guardians and gave up their power to act as surrogate parents. The ratification of the 26th Amendment to the Constitution in 1971, which lowered the voting age from 21 to 18, was even more consequential for student rights. Whether their lives were on the line in Vietnam or their voices raised in opposition to the war, young people became rights-bearing citizens. That constitutional amendment was followed, in 1972, by amendments to the Higher Education Act of 1965, whose Title IX provisions brought a new legal tool into play, providing a new remedy for problems such as discriminatory admissions policies and race or sex-based disparities in compensation. The 1972 amendments touched many aspects of campus life. Among other things, they changed some of the ways government assistance was delivered to students, creating basic educational opportunity grants, renamed Pell Grants in 1980, and establishing the Student Loan Marketing Association. With individuals able to apply for portable loans and grants, students gained a new status as individual consumers of higher education. The passage of the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act in 1974 bestowed yet another power on students by granting new privacy rights. If parents wanted to see grades or other personal records, students would have to give their permission, gaining an additional degree of autonomy from their parents. Meanwhile, the military draft came to an end in 1973. One scholar of higher education saw this spate of legislation in the 1970s as supremely ironic. At the very instant higher education finally succeeded at imbuing students with a sense of citizenship, he wrote, citizenship was rewrapped in a bundle of group and personal rights with few, if any, reciprocal obligations. Citizenship had become personalized, and like higher education and politics, it would never be the same. A rights-based concept of citizenship, intertwined with America's consumer culture, was changing whatever it might once have meant to be a minor, a dependent, and especially a college student. With students gaining a bundle of legal rights and having won a large measure of autonomy from university authorities, there was a powerful movement in the opposite direction, with one adult privilege snatched away, drinking alcohol. Ever since the end of Prohibition in 1933, the legal drinking age in New York had been set at 18 years of age. Federal law forced every state, including New York, to raise it to 19 in 1982 and to 21 in 1985. Campuses and college towns have never been free of alcohol, hard partying, and irresponsible students, but raising the drinking age drove alcohol consumption underground, and binge drinking became more common, worsening many of the social and behavioral problems associated with alcohol. Whether caused by the change in the legal drinking age or merely by coincidence, three fraternities at Colgate were sanctioned or shut down over a two-year period. A brawl between Phi Delta and Deke resulted in the closing of the Deke House for a semester and probation in 1985-86. Delta Upsilon received a two-year sanction ending in 1988, and Sigma Chi was suspended for the year 1987-88. While Colgate and most other universities had relinquished many of the bothersome features of in loco parentis, they were adding to their professional staffs to deal with residential life, counseling, and student health. They were also dealing with a new federal regulatory regime, heightened concerns about liability, and a greater likelihood of litigation. Of all the public policy measures, Title IX has undoubtedly had the most consequential impact on Colgate's transition to full coeducation. It came prominently into play in the ways it affected both women's and men's athletics. It provides a fitting coda to the story of coeducation's early years, as women athletes pursued their quest not only for a more equitable allocation of the university's athletic resources, but also to secure a place within Colgate's culture and to contribute to its ongoing traditions. When Colgate women first started to compete at the varsity level, they played within a budding national infrastructure for women's sports overseen by the Association for Intercollegiate Athletics for Women, which was founded in 1971. Wary of the National Collegiate Athletic Association, because of the over-commercialization of college sports and the academic corruption surrounding men's sports at some colleges, the AIAW set firm academic standards for female athletes, restricted off-campus recruiting, and established limits to sports-related financial aid. The AIAW was charting an alternate path for women's athletics, encouraging an exceptionally wide array of sports, as well as broader participation. Many women, even those who had not played team sports in high school, embraced Colgate's athletic traditions. Early on, Colgate fielded both varsity and junior varsity teams in women's sports, and some women played as many as three sports. The university's first recruited female athletes arrived on campus in 1976, and sports-related financial aid was extended for the first time to several women athletes entering in fall 1977. Colgate was a staunch supporter of the AIAW and competed in its Division II, enjoying early success in state and regional tournaments and even seeing its field hockey team advance to the national finals in 1979. It lost to Southwest Missouri State. Robert Massa reviewed Colgate's first decade of coeducation for his thesis at Columbia Teachers College. He found that in no other area of college programming has Colgate done as much for women in terms of offered opportunities and the quality of facilities and commitment as in the athletic program. Some find it ironic that athletics, a major symbol of all-male Colgate, has welcomed women so thoroughly into its structure. Ironic, perhaps, but it was not surprising. Girls were finding more extensive athletic opportunities in high school, and Title IX was driving major changes in athletics departments at the collegiate level. When Colgate's club softball team filed a complaint with the Office of Civil Rights in 1977, it promptly won varsity status, even as the OCR investigators concluded that the university was making solid progress in expanding its commitment to women's athletics. With women's college sports gaining fans and winning television contracts for its basketball tournament, the NCAA began to take notice and to see a financial opportunity. In 1980, it expanded its purview to women's athletics, hosting national championships in the most widely watched sports. Seeing the prospects for larger television revenues, universities with the most prominent programs soon abandoned the AIAW, switching their allegiance to the NCAA. Losing members and unable to mount a costly antitrust challenge against the NCAA, the AIAW folded in 1982. While Colgate chose to ally itself with the AIAW until the bitter end, it ultimately had no choice but to affiliate its varsity teams with the NCAA and have women compete, like Colgate men, at the Division I level. Under NCAA auspices after 1982, the trajectory of women's sports changed at Colgate. More clubs would attain varsity status, soccer in 1982 and cross-country in 1987. Facilities would gradually improve from the one locker room that all varsity women's teams had to share, and new coaches were hired. Slowly but surely, Colgate's seemed to be moving in the right direction in its support for women's athletics, but elevation to the NCAA's Division I would raise new questions about the competitive terrain for both men's and women's sports. The divide was widening between the big-money university programs playing in athletic conferences capable of winning lucrative television contracts and those schools, however well endowed, that chose to devote fewer dollars to their sports programs, whether in coaches' salaries, recruiting budgets, facilities, or athletic scholarships. Differences also grew between schools where student athletes, the NCAA's artful term to highlight their amateur status, were indeed representative of the student body, and those where, starkly put, the athletes were not. Colgate's athletic programs, male and female, faced new questions in the 1980s. Where would it find athletic competitors who shared its academic values? How much should it invest in its intercollegiate program? How many teams could it support? What sports would it favor as its so-called Tier 1 sports, those in which it hoped to be the most competitive? Which sports might have to be dropped? Once again, just as it had as early as the 1890s, Colgate was trying to find the appropriate balance between athletic ambitions, academic standards, and financial resources. An opportunity arose to resolve some of these issues for at least one sport, the most expensive, when the Ivy League decided to expand its football schedule from 9 to 10 games. The league approached the presidents of Holy Cross and Lehigh in 1980, hoping to create a non-scholarship football conference with which the Ivies could regularly schedule games. Playing as an independent, a school with no conference affiliation, Colgate was already taking on 4 and sometimes 5 Ivy teams each season. It was also enjoying a resurgence under Coach Fred Dunlop, class of 1950, who had returned to Hamilton in 1976. His team was undefeated, nationally ranked at the midpoint of the 1982 season, and likely to receive an invitation to play in the Division I 2A playoffs. When an article appeared in the New York Times fueling faculty worries about football's prominence and its effect on the school's academic reputation. The article's title told the story. Colgate's effort to change image upstaged by success in football. President George Langdon and Dunlop had tense conversations about the likelihood of the team extending its season to participate in the playoffs. Apparently, without informing the coach or team of his decision, Langdon wrote to the NCAA to say that Colgate would not participate because of conflicts with the university's final exam schedule. Ivy League teams did not compete, and neither should Colgate, in Langdon's view. Facing an alumni uprising and a legal challenge, Langdon reversed his decision, and the team went on to compete in 1982 and reached the quarterfinals. The Board of Trustees then clarified the university's position in March 1983, voting to allow the team to continue to participate in the playoffs, at least in the 1983 and 1984 seasons. At the same time, it urged the creation of a new league. In 1986, with the Ivy League acting as midwife, a 6-member football alliance was born. The charter members of what was initially called the Colonial League, Bucknell, Colgate, Davidson, Holy Cross, Lafayette, and Lehigh, all adhered to similar academic standards. The College of William and Mary flirted with joining. Davidson dropped out in 1988. The Ivy League committed itself to scheduling 16 games per season with the new league. In return, the members of the league agreed to set limits to their football programs. They would not offer athletic scholarships, only Holy Cross had previously given them. They would curtail spring football practices, and they would not compete in the NCAA Division I-IIA postseason playoffs. In time, the new league would change that course and decide to take part. Lehigh's president, Peter Likens, said that informing the league, the participating schools were making a strong statement about intercollegiate football. We believe the student athlete should be representative of the student body. This means our athletes must measure up academically. Renamed the Patriot League in 1990, it became a more complete athletic conference with 22 sports, 11 each for men and women, although not all league members played every sport. It also added 2 new members, Fordham and the United States Military Academy. The Naval Academy would join a year later. Various members have come and gone over the years, some as associate members joining to play only 1 or 2 sports. Fordham remained only for football. Like the Ivy schools, the Patriot League schools devised an academic index, a formula based on grades and test scores to assure that its student athletes would be competitive in the classroom as well as on the playing field. With the advent of the Patriot League and the prospects of end-of-season NCAA competition, women's sports continued to expand at Colgate, generally tracking national trends. By the mid-1990s, nearly 40% of Colgate's approximately 500 varsity athletes were women, although their teams received only about 1/3 of the athletic operating budget and the available scholarship funds. While trends were moving in the right direction, some thought that more needed to be done to comply with Title IX. In 1995, Colgate drafted a 4-year gender equity plan. By the end of 4 years, we should be in pretty good shape, said Associate Athletic Director Janet Little. It doesn't mean things will be equal, but they will be fair and equitable. The terms equal, equity, and equitable were never precisely defined and could be viewed in several ways. The NCAA's definitions were based on the number of women athletes in proportion to their number in the undergraduate student body, a test which Colgate failed to meet, with only about 40% playing varsity sports when, by the mid-1990s, more than half the students were female. Fewer than 10% of Division I schools could meet that test of proportionality. If equity were based on the number of athletic teams rather than players, then Colgate's 20 varsity teams, 10 for men and 10 for women, suggested that the university was fulfilling its commitment to gender equity. But budgets remained unequal for men's and women's sports overall, with football alone consuming over a quarter of the Colgate athletic budget. The Tier 1 teams, the 5 sports in which the university aimed to be the most competitive, and thus holding out modest prospects for generating revenue, received about 60% of the athletic budget. Ice hockey, a costly sport, would present Colgate with its most dramatic and lengthy Title IX test. The men's hockey teams, which played on Taylor Lake beginning in 1922, were perennially strong and contended for a national title in 1990. Women began to play ice hockey soon after their arrival on campus, competing in intramurals in 1972 and organizing a club team a year later, even though very few girls of that era had had opportunities to play the sport in high school. A core group of high school field hockey, soccer, and lacrosse players, a few figure skaters, and some with no athletic experience at all, formed the first club teams. Competing in ill-fitting, faded maroon hand-me-down uniforms from the men's team and borrowed intramural helmets with many team members wearing figure skates, they covered the picks in adhesive tape, The club team scheduled whatever opponents they could find and kept hopes alive for someday winning varsity status. However, their petitions to become a varsity sport were turned down in 1979, 1983, 1986, and 1988, and the club's budget in the late 1980s was a paltry $4,000. After repeated denials of their petitions, five teammates sued in April 1990. Their case came before a United States magistrate in 1992 who ruled that the differential treatment of the male and female hockey players was indeed a violation of Title IX, although he awarded no damages to the plaintiffs. Colgate was ordered to elevate the team to varsity status no later than the 1993-94 season. This was the first time Title IX had ever been applied to a specific sport rather than to a college's overall levels of athletic participation and funding. "By ordering us to add a specific sport by a specific date," said athletic director Mark Murphy, class of 77, who was himself a lawyer, "the judge has really gone beyond what Title IX intended. Typically, you analyze the entire program. You give the university discretion on how they handle that problem. However, there was no discretion whatsoever." He contended that the lawsuit brought everything to a head. The ruling posed financial challenges for Colgate and was viewed by some as a threat to the university's commitment to other club and varsity sports. The university concluded that it could not let the magistrate's decision stand. Couching its appeal in narrow procedural terms, Colgate's lawyers contended that the plaintiffs would not benefit from the ruling since all would have graduated by the time a varsity team took the ice. On those grounds, the case was dismissed by the U.S. Second Circuit Court of Appeals in April 1993. Both sides were unhappy. For the hockey players still in school, the elevation to varsity status was again delayed, while for the university, equity under Title IX remained a murky concept. The hockey players then pursued their case as a class action suit, with court hearings and negotiations dragging on for several more years. The settlement of the class action suit finally came in January 1997, ending the 7-year-long battle. President Grabois announced that women's hockey would be elevated to varsity status as a non-emphasized sport and would receive $40,000 in annual funding. The team at long last was assured of adequate equipment, new uniforms every 3 years, a per diem for travel, more timely access to the rink and team training rooms, a recruiting budget, and more compelling publicity materials. "I couldn't be happier for the underclassmen," a senior player commented, "but for us, it's sort of bittersweet." Elevated to varsity status, the women entered competition at the NCAA's Division III level, and in 2001, 28 years after first competing at the club level, women's hockey joined the ranks of the ECAC as a Division I varsity team. 17 years after that, in March 2018, the team completed its season with a 34-6-1 record, sharing the ECAC regular season title and reaching the finals of the NCAA tournament, where it lost to Clarkson in overtime. Although they were runners-up, they had equaled the success of the most accomplished men's team, which in 1990 had also vied for a national title, only to be defeated in the finals by the University of Wisconsin. In a measure of cold revenge for the men, the women had defeated Wisconsin in their semifinal game. While the Title IX case centered on women's hockey, other teams were waiting to be moved up to the varsity level. Women's and men's crew, which together attracted about 100 rowers, was growing into one of the largest sports at the university. Team members argued that there was already genuine equity between their teams since they competed out of the same boathouse, used the same shells, and traveled together in the same vans. They shared coaches, and at the time of their request, the coxswains for both teams were women. In September 1997, acting on a proposal from team members, President Grabois announced that in the fall of 2000, the crew teams would also row at the varsity level after 23 years as a club sport. The balance between men's and women's sports continued to improve, and by the early 2000s, Colgate was supporting 13 women's teams and 12 men's teams, all competing at the NCAA's Division I level. Their success on the courts, playing fields, and ice was one area in which full coeducation had arrived. And in 2012, in another signal of the rise of women's sports, Victoria Chun, class of 91, an All-Patriot League volleyball player in her student days and a winning coach when she returned to Colgate, was tapped as the university's athletic director, among the first women to lead a Division I program. Whatever Emily Taylor and Mabel Dart might have envisioned for women's education in the 19th century, they could never have foreseen that a commitment to competitive athletics would be part of a movement toward full coeducation and even fuller gender equality in the 21st.